Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for Twit's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. And thanks for your continued support. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, February 12th, 2017. This is episode 1363. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. See what's on the menu this week and get three meals free with your first purchase with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/techguy. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/techguy. And by 23andMe, a personalized genetic service based on your 23 pairs of chromosomes found right there in your DNA. For Valentine's Day this year, give that special person the gift of knowledge. Go to 23andMe.com and get $20 off when you buy before Valentine's Day. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Yeah. It's your worst nightmare, a geek with his own radio show. What? Whoever thought that was a good idea? 8888 Ask Leo. That's the geek number. 888-827-5536. That's toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. Outside those areas, you can still call. You just use your Skype there and call us using Skype out. 888-827-5536. What do we talk about? Well, you know, anything with a chip in it. So that would be computers, the internet. Does the internet have a chip in it? It's got a chip on its shoulder. I guess, you know, whatever runs the internet has a chip in it. Anything you access the internet from has a chip in it. But the internet itself, what is the internet? It's a puffy little cloud. It doesn't feel like it's a physical thing, does it? I mean, it's just really consists of a bunch of computers connected together via wires. That's really all it is. Anyway, no chips in the wires, chips in the routers, chips in the computers. Virtual reality, augmented reality, that's a big topic these days. Tim Cook, who's touring right now, he's doing Mr. Cook Goes to Europe. He's touring around and speaking. And he gave an interview to the British newspaper, The Independent, in which he said about AR, about augmented reality, "I regard it," says Tim Cook, the chairman of Apple, CEO of Apple, "I regard it as a big idea like the smartphone." Here's Leo's footnote. Let's put a little asterisk. "The smartphone, which Apple did not invent but perfected, has become Apple's biggest business by a long shot." Long margin. Big margin. The Apple iPhone powers Apple and has made it the most valuable company in the world. End footnote. "The smartphone," says Tim, "the smartphone is for everyone. We don't have to think the iPhone is about a certain demographic or country or vertical market. It's for everyone. You should all buy one. Because it's for you." He says, "I think AR is that big. It's huge." He says huge with a H. Because huge, because he's from the South. "I get excited because of the things." He does has a little bit of a drawl. He went to Auburn. If you want to get on as Tim Cook's good side, you say "War Eagle." And he will say "War Darn Eagle" right back at you. It's amazing. "I get excited," says Tim Cook, "because of the things that could be done that could improve a lot of lives and be entertaining." He said that. And be entertaining. That's an afterthought. Improve lives and be entertaining. It's like this show. Maybe not in the same measure, but, you know. So Tim's been saying, talking about AR for a year now. But this is really the biggest, most important thing he said about it at this point, which is, as I read it, because Apple, you got to figure, Apple's looking for the next iPhone, right? The next big thing that's going to power it into the 21st century. The iPhone's done very well for Apple, but sales are kind of, their growth is slowing. They had a really big quarter with the new iPhone, but you know, that's every fourth quarter they have a huge bump from a new iPhone, and then it tapers off a little bit. And it's not going to go forever. Even Apple said that a couple of quarters ago. It's not going to go forever. They said that. So what's the next big thing? You know, Apple's looking at that. And they were, at first, we thought, looking at TVs. Well, at least one analyst, Gene Munster, really banged that drum for a while. Gene's kind of shut up. Yeah, they're not going to do a TV. Then everybody's all excited about Project Titan, Apple's car project. They were going to build an automobile. Then we found out they laid off a lot of that group, and they maybe aren't going to be doing that after all. It's augmented realities next. Cook goes on to say that he views AR like the silicon used in iPhone's chips, a core technology. It's not a product per se. It's a core technology, which means Apple sees it in everywhere. Not just, you know, the first thing you'd think is, oh, well, they're just going to put augmented reality to the phone. Maybe give you, I don't know what. But really, augmented reality isn't like VR. Because VR, you're playing a game, or you're not moving around a whole heck of a lot. So you can put virtual reality visor on that you can't see the outside world. So you just, you know, it can be a big, clunky, stupid-looking thing, which it is. If you've ever seen anybody wear a virtual reality headset. Parenthetically, they had these demo units was it Best Buy? They had like little Oculus virtual reality booths you could try it, and nobody tried it, so they've closed them. Because nobody wants to be in public looking like that. You know, you look goofy. But AR is different. AR, it's best when used in public, or at least in front of your computer and maybe walking around the office. And so it can't look that dopey. Everybody seems to think, and who knows what Apple will do, but augmented reality would be maybe something look like spectacle, like regular glasses, but with more capability, which is a lot of work. And Microsoft's trying to do this with their HoloLens. They have a PC and a battery and everything built into something that you could put on as glasses, and it's very limited as a result. Don't think Apple would want to release something like Microsoft's HoloLens. It's too limited. They dream big. Maybe I'm assuming incorrectly that augmented reality is view through your eyes, because remember, Apple is also very interested in headphone technology. Augmented reality doesn't have to be visual; it could be audio, oral audio, right? Could be as you're walking around, somebody whispering in your ear. You know, like that walks behind the president and says, "That's the ambassador to Burundi. Don't ask him about his savings account," that kind of thing. You know, you could be wearing those Apple AirPods, and they could be saying things in your ear. You are now at the store. On your left is Levi's. On the right is Blouses. There's a really good deal 13 feet ahead of you. Watch out! Watch out for the shopper who's grabbing everything. That kind of thing. Maybe that's what he's talking about. I don't know. The Verge writes, "These comments are not just the random pontifications of a tech CEO. Apple and Cook in particular have honed their skills at cryptically talking up product roadmaps, announcements, and secret projects without having to confirm on the record that the company is up to anything at all. They're just an indication to investors, analysts, and fans, we're working on this. And something might be announced someday." But, you know, we know because, you know, they post job listings, so we kind of know they're hiring people to do this, augmented reality and virtual reality. But what would it be? And I think we shouldn't assume it's tied to the iPhone. I think he's almost saying that. I, for one, am very excited about that. I talked a little bit on the last show about how we're at the hockey stick inflection point. You know, as things grow, they start slowly, but then it comes a point when they're growing exponentially where they just go, whoo, they just take off. That's the bend in the hockey stick. And I think we're at the bend in the hockey stick in several technologies which might intermingle to create something really interesting. Artificial intelligence, voice interaction, like the Amazon Echo, Siri, you know, we've got miniaturization down, right? You can get in your phone now. A lot of this is due to Apple and the fact that they make so many phones. They sold 78.5 million iPhones last quarter in 3 months. So that means that there's this incredible system of manufacture that can get stuff really tiny, including things like accelerometers, motion sensors, gyroscopes, barometric percent, a lot of sensors. That's why we have the drone industry. Wouldn't be there without the iPhone first. So all of that's combining in interesting ways, and I think augmented reality might be the natural culmination of all three of those tech. Voice, artificial intelligence, miniaturization, who knows? It's an interesting world we live in. 8888-ASK, Leo. Let's talk about what's going on right now in your tech life. I'll go to the phones next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
You're up.
Oh, Al Jarreau passed. Love Al Jarreau. May have to listen to some Al Jarreau tonight. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK, Leo. That's the phone number. 888-827-5536. And who will be answering that phone? Well, I'll tell you right now. It'll be the lovely and talented Kim Schaffer, whom we have stuck into a booth for her own protection. The paparazzi are swarming outside.
They are?
Of course they are.
I think I'll go find them.
Paparazzi.
I can use a little of that right now.
Hi, Kim.
How are you?
I'm well.
Good.
We have, did anybody call?
The second week in a row you're asking me that.
Did anybody call?
I'm sure.
Yeah. It's like Veep, you know, on that TV show on HBO. She's every time she goes by her assistant, she says, "Did the president call?" And this person goes, "No, of course not." Anybody call? Did anybody call? Actually,
yeah,
we have some calls.
You have some calls, and coincidentally, the first one's name is Chip, and you were mentioning chips right at the beginning.
If it's got a chip in it,
and immediately the phone rang, and it was Chip.
This is Chip.
It's Chip. Chip in Philadelphia.
Thank you, Kim. Hello, Chip in Philadelphia. Welcome.
Hi, Leo.
Hi. How are you? Yeah, welcome. Hi. Join the show. Good to have you. It's got a chip in it. The show has a chip in it now. What can we do for you?
So must be my lucky day then. Yeah, I had this question before, and it was posted on there. My images are disappearing from my Samsung Galaxy phones, both on the S3 and the S5 that I have.
When you say disappearing, you mean they don't show up in the camera roll after a period of time?
Right. They don't show up. I mean, I shut my phone down every day in order to give it a rest, but when I turn it back on, sometimes it appears, sometimes it doesn't. Now, I deleted the no media file. I think you remember talking about this. So if you search in the Tech Guy forum, in quotes, no media, you'll find that the discussion. And it worked for a while. You told me to update the phone. On my S5, I updated it. It came back. And then it disappeared again. So I don't know what's going on. It's the phone seems to have a life of its own.
Yeah, so it's deleting photos. That's interesting. And you say they sometimes come back?
Yeah, if I delete the no media file, it's like weird. It's I downloaded an app which located no media file. I deleted it. It all came back, and then it was gone again. And I used the same app again. It doesn't work.
Are you using the Samsung Gallery app? The app that Samsung puts on there to look at photos.
That's right. I'm looking at that. Yes.
Okay. And do you have any other photo apps on there? Do you have the Google Photos app, for instance?
No.
Okay. Why don't you download? That's a better Photos app anyway. And one of the reasons I'd like you to use it, even on a Samsung phone, is it backs up to Google for free all your pictures. So at least you'll know they're safe. It's just called Photos. It's in the Play Store. The reason I asked is because one of the things Photos will do, although you have to instruct it to do so, is clear up space on your storage by copying photos to the Google Cloud and then deleting them on the phone. That's one way that you can save space. Have you checked to see your free space on the phone?
Yeah, I don't have an SD card in there, so it's probably storing and using up their space, but I still have plenty of space. Now, it's doing that on the S3, but the S3 isn't that bad. I haven't updated the S3, but I don't have to delete the no media file every time I turn the phone on. Maybe it's doing that once a month, so I can
look. Yeah, just so people listening understand what we're talking about, you can create a file called .nomedia and put it in any given folder, and then whatever is in that folder will no longer show up in the music folder, in the music or in the photos. It's essentially saying, here's a folder that contains stuff, but I don't want that stuff to be visible in my gallery application. I'm not sure, first of all, so you're saying this .nomedia is being created?
Yeah, it's being created without my authorization. I mean, it just shows up on there. And I've read from the forum, people say there's something wrong with the no media files. That's why you could delete it and it'll come back. But people are saying...
Well, I wonder what's creating it. Yeah. I mean, Norm, this is a little trick to create a folder that isn't scanned. It can speed up your phone, because it won't have to look in this folder to see if there's any media files in it. It shouldn't be being created. My suspicion is you have an app on there that's doing that. I feel like that's probably what's going on, but I'm not, you know, it's impossible for me to tell. The best thing to do at this point, and it wouldn't be a bad idea to do this anyway, on both the 3 and the 5, would be to do a factory reset. Just wipe the phone and start over again. Don't install every app immediately automatically. In fact, it will do that if you don't stop it from doing that. That's kind of a convenience thing on Android phones. It keeps track of what apps you had installed and will re-download those. Don't do that yet. What I would suggest is that you wipe the phone, take some pictures, see if this behavior recurs. It shouldn't. This is not normal behavior. It should not. If it does, then I don't have an answer for you. But if it doesn't, and this is my suspicion, then you can slowly put your apps back on there. And some app is doing this. Something is doing this. And again, I don't, you know, this is one of the reasons I'm not a fan of the Samsung, or have become less of a fan of the Samsung phones. Samsung, for some reason, probably to differentiate it from other Android devices, feels obligated to put on there its own calendar app, its own gallery app, its own messages app, its own voice dictation app, all of which duplicate exactly the functionality of Google. They add nothing to the mix except that it's tied to a Samsung account. And, you know, I mean, there's some Samsung benefits, I guess, mostly accruing to Samsung. And I don't want all that stuff on there. I want to use the Google, there are many, messaging app, the Google Photos app. The Google Photos app is inarguably better than the gallery app that Samsung provides. Google's voice recognition, hey Google, or whatever it is, Google Now, is inarguably better than the Samsung S voice. And on and on and on. I don't understand why Samsung has a calendar on there and Google has a calendar on there. So disable the Samsung apps. Use the Google apps. It's one of the reasons I use a Google Pixel. There aren't any third-party apps put on there. And then you're going to try to track down what app is putting a no media file on there. If that's really what's going on, if that's why your disappearing photos are disappearing, they're not disappearing in the sense that they're gone from the phone. They're disappearing because they just don't show up in the gallery app because the gallery respects this .nomedia file. But it shouldn't just appear spontaneously in the photos folder anyway. That's odd. I would wipe it and start over. And next time, maybe we should. I'll be buying the new S8 because I have to review it. But I'm kind of pretty much sticking with the Google Pixels, the Google Pure phones from now on. Just there's too much cruft put on there, not just by manufacturers like Samsung, but by carriers as well. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number. More of your calls right after this.
Hello, Leo. This is Matthew from the UK.
Hello, Matthew.
Hope you're okay. I'm trying to call you today from the UK on Skype, and it won't let me.
So you have to use Skype out.
The party you are trying to trying to reach does not accept unidentified calls.
Oh, that's it. That's that same problem. Yeah, this is related to the unidentified. People have been complaining the last 2 weeks about we also don't accept calls from blocked numbers. So it must see Skype as a blocked number. No, I won't send you a free MacBook. Okay, so I got it. That we have seen and we have reported, and they're working on. The engineers are trying to figure out why all of a sudden unidentified numbers are being refused. We'll fix that. It's some weird thing. Yeah, you were, Matthew. That was you. Ernesto is in Las Vegas, our next caller. Hi, Ernesto.
Hi, Leo. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I seem to have an issue. I finally was able to join the land of the living, so to speak, and go from an iPhone 4 to the new iPhone 7.
Yay!
It's nice, but
it's three better.
I'm computer savvy, but yeah. I noticed that my iMac is, I guess, a little dated. And when I try to sync up my iPhone to my iTunes library, because of course I've got so many music on my iMac, it's not compatible to the iPhone 7. Is there a way to get my music somehow off my vintage computer onto the new?
So frustrating. Yeah. So I feel like this is Apple's continued revenue plan. Which is that if you upgrade your phone, then you have to upgrade everything else so it'll work with it. You have to have a version, I can't remember if it's version 11 or version 12 of iTunes in order to connect to the phone. And you can't run version 12 of iTunes unless you have, I don't know the exact details, but probably something like Mountain Lion or Yosemite or later. And you can't run Yosemite on your computer because it's too old. So if you buy a new iPhone, you have to buy a new computer. Now, that's only if you want to connect it via the wire. So there are other ways to do this, all of which make money for Apple, by the way. You can have iTunes, and this is what I would suggest. You can have iTunes store your music in the cloud. Pay for iTunes Match or Apple Music, either one. I would say $25 a year is a good price for iTunes Match. Then what happens with iTunes Match, and it takes a few days, is it goes through your entire music collection and duplicates it in the cloud. In most cases, it's got the song already, so it doesn't have to store it up there. But if it's something that's unique to your, maybe it's a recording of your daughter or something, it will upload that. Then all of those will be stored in the cloud. Then when you log into your iCloud account on your phone, it'll be available for you just to download from the cloud. So that's the easiest way of getting all your music or a selection of your music from your computer to the phone without having to upgrade your computer is use iTunes Match.
And you find iTunes Match?
Well, I'm hoping that come to think of it. Oh, this will make me mad. I'm hoping that this will work with your vintage Macintosh. If it doesn't, if it's not available, and make sure you have the latest version of the Mac OS on there that you can get in the latest version of iTunes. If it's not available, then there is another solution that's a third-party solution. And actually, I use this solution. I like it. It's a player for Macintosh and iPhone called Vox, V-O-X. It's available in the Apple Store, App Store as well on the iPhone. It has a storage solution. I actually use this that you can upload all your music to from your Mac and download it or stream it even from your player on your phone. So Vox would be good. Match needs, I'm seeing the chat room. Yasha is telling me in the chat room, iTunes 10.5.1. What version of iTunes is the newest you can use?
Okay.
Well, I don't know. I don't know which it is. Yeah. So you always want to run the latest operating system Apple will let you install. And then that'll automatically give you the latest version of iTunes. If Match is not available, Vox is a good alternative. There used to be, and actually, let me ask the chat room if they know if this, I think it went away, but there used to be something called Double Twist, which was awesome. Double Twist would, and this was a free solution, would automatically scan your iTunes library and use Wi-Fi to sync it to your phone.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah. And in theory, that should work for a lot of things on the phone anyway. They don't want you to have to wire your phone anymore to your Macintosh. But I would take a look at Double Tunes. Double Twist, I should say. Double Twist. Yep.
Okay, I'll check Vox, and hopefully Double Twist.
Double Twist is free, and that's the best solution that costs you nothing.
Well, Leo, I appreciate your help.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. Double Twist was created by DVD John. He's no longer a teenager, but the guy who cracked DVD in copy protection years ago. He was a high school student at the time. It was called named DVD John, and he made some money on it. And yeah, I guess Double Twist is still available at doubletwist.com for the Mac. Question is if they still have an iPhone version. I'm sure they do. If they make it for the Mac, they must have an iPhone version. So those are three good ways to do it. Doubletwist.com. I like Vox for one reason. It isn't free, so it's not the cheapest solution. But Vox plays back high-res music on your Macintosh, music of a higher quality than iTunes can play. So if you buy music that's recorded at 24-bit or higher than, you know, CD quality is 44,100 hertz per second, samples per second, 44.1 kilohertz at 16-bit resolution. But you can buy records that are recorded at 92 kilohertz at 24-bit resolution. In fact, that's usually how records are made. And then they're downsampled for putting on a CD. So there are some people, I probably don't have the ears that can tell the difference, but there are some people who do. Your Mac is capable of playing back this 9224 music if you set it up that way, but you need a player to do it, and Vox will do it. Is it 96? Okay, it's 9624. Right, because it's not exactly double, is it? Oh, well. 96 kilohertz, 24-bit. There's even 192 kilohertz. That you definitely can't hear the difference. In fact, I think a lot of people say, you know, all you really need is 44.1, the CD quality sample rate by 24-bit samples, higher resolution samples, and that's plenty of accuracy. Tim is on the line from, Diana, Texas? Hi, Tim.
That's right, Diana, Texas. It's a pleasure to talk to you, Leo.
Nice to talk to you, Tim. Thanks for calling.
Sure. Say, I've got a Note 5 phone, and it's on the Straight Talk network.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not getting any security updates or firmware updates. Is there some place I can go to download that?
Yeah, that's Straight Talk's fault, because Samsung says they're going to keep the Note 5 up to date. Google puts out now, just like Microsoft does, a monthly security patch. And it's probably a good idea for everybody using an Android phone just to look in the About Phone section and see what the most recent security patch you've received is. If it's not January 2017, in some cases, in fact, I think the Samsung S7 has already got February 2017. If you're not getting that, that means you are somewhat vulnerable, and there have been security issues on the Android phone that you're not getting fixed. Samsung, so there's the problem is it takes the cooperation of three parties. First of all, Google has to make the patch available because they make the operating system Android. Your phone manufacturer has to approve it because, as you know, on your Note 5, there's all sorts of different things Samsung has done to the user interface. So Samsung has to take Google's patches, make sure they work, update them or change them to make sure that they work with Samsung's system. And then Samsung passes it along to your carrier, and your carrier is the one who ends up pushing that out. Straight Talk sounds like Straight Talk's inexpensive.
Yeah.
And it sounds like they may be not pushing it out. I would call Straight Talk and say, what's the deal?
Okay.
I want my updates. How do you get them otherwise? Well, you can't really, unless you're willing to root your phone and put a third-party operating system or firmware on there. And I'll talk about that a little bit when we come back, because we got to take a break. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You know what I'm doing this week? I can't remember what we ordered. I'm cooking. I got my Blue Apron box coming, I think, tomorrow. I'm so excited. Blue Apron's nice because, so you've probably heard me talk about it. How do I describe it? They send you a box, refrigerated box, with every ingredient you need to make an amazing meal, either for a couple or for your family. You choose the subscription you want. You never get a package. It's not like automatic. You never get one when you don't want it. Let me go to blueapron.com/tech guy. You could do that too, actually, if you want to follow along. blueapron.com/tech guy. And take a look at what's on the menu this week. There's some amazing stuff. I forgot what we ordered. But, that's one of the fun things. You get the box. Inside, exactly the ingredients you need. No more, no less to make an amazing meal. You see, they get little bottles there of soy sauce. You don't get a whole big bottle. You get exactly what you need. So there's no waste. They also give you a recipe card that tells you exactly how to cook this amazing meal. Everything is delicious inside. Fresh produce from local farms, seasonally, grown. You get meat with no added hormones, sustainably sourced seafood. And the price is right, too. It's less, not only less than a restaurant, of course, it's actually less than the grocery store because they don't have the overhead. And once you make one of these great Blue Apron meals, you can do it again and again. You go, oh, now I know how to do that. Kids will love it, too. They're really designed, Blue Apron is to build a community of home chefs, people who cook with their family. In fact, on average, according to research, families with Blue Apron cook together 3 times more often. Blue Apron delivers free to 99% of the continental United States. There's no weekly commitment. You get deliveries when you want them. You choose what you want from their menu, including dietary restrictions. Yes, they have vegetarian plans and, everything that you'd need. Udon noodle soup with miso and soft-boiled eggs. I don't even know what this is. Vaduvan spiced vegetable fritters with lemon yogurt and butter lettuce salad. Roasted broccoli and fragola sarda with pepper and olive salsa. Those are vegetarian. But they also have lamb, beef, and mushroom stew and seared chicken and pearl couscous or tempura fried cod. That's the two-person plan. The family plan for a family of four has more family-friendly ingredients, kid-friendly ingredients, and is just as delicious. You're going to love Blue Apron, and their freshness guarantee promises every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they will make it right. BlueApron.com/tech guy. Get your first 3 meals free with your first purchase and free shipping by going to BlueApron.com/tech guy. I'll take pictures of our box this week. Cashew chicken stir fry with tango mandarins and jasmine rice. Roasted pork with apple, walnut, and farro salad. Crispy barramundi fish with quinoa and roasted carrot salad. I'm talking good stuff. Delicious. BlueApron.com/tech guy for your first 3 meals free with your purchase. Yes, I have the Beatles metal apple. I bought that because I wanted the 24-bit. It's 44-1 24-bit FLAC, and it does sound very good. I agree. I bought that. I actually bought it used because they don't sell it anymore, but I found a seller on eBay who was selling it for a decent amount of money. And you know what? I'm too old. I've realized because I have a Pono player. I have all this high quality stuff. I bought high res sounds. I can't tell the difference. No, I watched. I did not. I watched The Hard Day's Night last night. It was on Turner Classic Movies. It was really fun. I love that movie. That was 64. It was before they really were as big as they were going to get. In fact, I think in some ways it was aspirational. Like they wanted to be that big. Have you seen 8 Days a Week? I haven't seen that yet. I am a bit of a Beatles fan. I read last year Tune In, the new Beatles biography. The one thing I found really interesting on these high-res recordings is there is a uncompressed, not talking about digital compression, I'm talking about dynamic range compression. There is a very low or uncompressed version of Band on the Run available. And I find that fascinating because, pop songs, they just like the radio, they compress the audio dynamic range to make it sound punchier. And Band on the Run, actually current pop songs are even more compressed. But even Band on the Run, which is, what, 30 or 40 years old now, was pretty compressed. So when you hear it uncompressed, you hear the instruments in a more flat, kind of interesting way. And I really like it when you have Beatles. Good. I'll get 8 days a week. 32 minutes. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I think the Beatles, the metal apple, the FLAC versions. So there's some debate when the Beatles were when the music was remastered from the tapes, what quality it was remastered. And so no one knows. The highest quality that's ever been sold commercially is 44/124-bit. So those are the ones I bought. I can't tell the difference. And then there's more to talk about. Yeah, that's it. Uncompressed. Yep, that's where I got it. HD Tracks. It's kind of interesting. I enjoy listening to it. It sounds different. It sounds very different. But you hear the instruments much more, you know, naturally. What was I going to talk about? Oh, rooting your Android phone. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888, ask Leo, the phone number. So if you have an older Android device, there is something you can do to it that will let you keep it more up to date if your carrier or the manufacturer doesn't want to update it. But it is kind of a geeky thing to do, and I should say right up front, it runs the risk that you will brick the phone. You know what that means? Turn it into a piece of useless glass, metal, and plastic. Turn it into a very expensive brick. I warn you of that because I don't want to be held responsible if that happens. However, having rooted many an Android phone, I've found that it's pretty easy and safe to do if you follow the instructions to the T. My advice is to go to a online forum called the XDA Developers, xda-developers.com. And their forums have instructions for rooting virtually every kind of Android phone. Samsung's are a little tricky. Samsung actually takes measures to prevent rooting. Although Google's attitude towards rooting has always been, that's fine, it's your phone. What is rooting? Well, it's not jailbreaking. I think sometimes people confuse it. And on the iPhone, there's something you can do to an iPhone, don't recommend it, called jailbreaking that allows you to buy iPhone apps from stores other than Apple's. That's all it lets you do. On an Android phone, there's just a little checkbox that jailbreaks it and says, I choose to buy from other stores. Okay, you understand that's dangerous? Yes, I do. Okay, go ahead. So that's easy to do on an Android phone. Rooting is a little more complicated. It's giving you sysadmin privileges. You know, on a Windows machine, you're administrator, or Mac, you're administrator. In the Unix world, we call it the root user. It's all powerful. You can do anything. And generally, when phones are shipped, they don't want the user to be able to do anything, like erase the phone, so they give you limited user capabilities. But with some tricks, in most cases, you can take an Android phone and root it, which gives you permission to do anything you want. The next thing you'll do is you'll replace the bootloader, the firmware that all computers have, right, when they first turn on, that tell them, hey, you're a computer, because it's a box of rocks. What? You're a computer? Oh. And then, I'm a computer. And then where to look for instructions. Now, look over here in storage to know what to do next. Okay. And then it goes there. I'm loading an operating system. So they call that recovery mode or the bootloader. You modify that because the one that Samsung provides, LG provides, even Google provides is restricted. But now that you're root, hey, you can do whatever you want. You're going to modify it, replace it with a custom bootloader that lets you choose other firmware, install other operating systems. They're all Android still in most cases, but what they are is modified versions of Android. A lot of people provide more up-to-date versions than your carrier. So your Samsung Galaxy S3, I think it can only go to KitKat. The S5, I think, can go now to Marshmallow, but not Nougat. But what if you wanted to put Nougat on an S3 or or just customize it in some ways. Well, this is what you would do. You would root it. You would replace the bootloader, put a custom bootloader on it, and then choose. The bootloader usually lets you choose a different ROM, or you download it to the phone and then have the bootloader launch it. And then you've modified the phone. You've literally replaced the operating system with a new operating system or modified operating system. This is not as kooky as it sounds. It's certainly a good way of keeping an older Android phone secure and up to date. But again, you've got to follow the instructions carefully. And you have to use ROMs that are specific, very specific to your model of phone. Not just the Galaxy S5, but your particular Galaxy S5 North American version, or, you know, Middle East version, or because they're different. So you have, but this is where XDA Developers is very handy. XDA-developers.com. Just search for your exact model of phone by model number, and then go there. And that'll tell you, A, if you can root it, and B, how to do that. And this is one of the joys of having an Android phone, is that you are able to modify it directly in interesting ways. And I think it's a good thing, because one of the hazards of having an Android phone is that there's malware out there, and you do need to get those updates. Again, this is one more argument for getting a Pixel phone from Google, because they're keeping those up to date. David in Little Rock, Arkansas. Hi, David.
Hey, Leo. How are you doing?
Wonderful. Welcome to the show.
Sure. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a longtime listener and learned a lot from you over the years.
Thank you.
I got a quick question for you about Google Voice. A couple of weeks ago, I guess they updated it for the first time in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an iPhone user, and I wanted to start kind of playing with Google Voice and to see how to use it and whatnot. But there are all these other Google messaging apps, Duo and Allo.
Oh,
and
man. Google's really,
Hangouts and stuff.
Google's really confused this almost beyond repair. And it's worse on Android.
For an iPhone user, I know iMessage works great.
Yeah, in general, iPhone users should probably stick with Apple-provided programs because they're going to work best. One of the reasons is Apple locks the phone down. So, for instance, on an Android device, I can choose what my SMS message, which app my SMS messages will go to. It's one of the reasons Google has this plethora of choices, because any one of them can be your main SMS app. On the iPhone, only Apple's messages can be your SMS message.
Right.
Same thing with the browser. Safari is the only default browser. You can have other browsers. You can have other messaging apps, but you're going to have to jump through hoops to use it. You can't just, for instance, let's say you get a message that says, hey, follow this link. You click the link. Safari will always launch, even if you have Chrome on there.
Right.
In general, in my opinion, if you're buying an iPhone, you're buying it because you, among other things, great hardware, really cool, you believe in Apple's way of doing things. And you agree, in effect, you're agreeing to use Apple's messages and to use Safari as your default. So,
well, in terms of Google Voice, I mean, I like the idea of being able to direct my phone calls.
Well, I do that. I do that. So Google Voice can be managed from the web.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have a single Google Voice number, which I have because I'm always using different phones for review purposes. It's great for me. You can have up to 5 different numbers. When somebody rings my main number, my Google Voice number, all of my phones, including my iPhone, ring. Messages go into Google Voice, and Google Voice will help you set that up. It's, you know, depending on your carrier, there's different ways to do that.
Right.
It's a little bit kludgy. It's a little bit ugly because when you do it the Apple way, everything just kind of flows together naturally.
Okay, so that goes to my next question about the browser, and then you would suggest sticking.
Yeah, there are other good browsers. What I would do is download an ad blocker, like Crystal Ad Blocker, and turn that on in Safari. That will really help your mobile browsing a lot. But I don't think there's a better browser any more than there's a better messaging app. A lot of people use WhatsApp, for instance, on iPhone. But you use that kind of as in addition to Apple's messages. All your SMS messages are always going to go to Apple messages. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, all that jazz. 888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. Ring it up. Talk to Kim Schaffer. Get on the air. That's what Taj did. from Oregon. Hi, Taj.
Hey.
Welcome.
Hey, I got a question for you about these Epson printers. I mean, it's awesome what they've done with that EcoTank.
Yeah.
They've been buying those CIS systems and putting them in, and they're kind of a real pain because sometimes they work, and they'll work for a while, then they won't, and then you're messing with a bunch of ink and, you know, nothing that can
be. No, this is a much better way to do it because it's approved by the manufacturer. Now, Epson's a sponsor. Got to say that. Disclaimer, Epson's a sponsor. But I bought two of them, so I put my money where my mouth is, literally.
Well, I bought four or five of them.
Oh, nice!
I
mean, I think it's brave of them because it turns the model on its head. Remember, inkjet printer manufacturers for years basically gave away the printer and made it up with very expensive ink.
Yes.
So, and there was a challenge for Epson, and I know I've talked to them because they knew that the printer would cost more up front because you're buying 2 years of ink, but they are able to, because you do that, they're able to charge a lot less for the ink. So you save money in the long run, but they weren't sure consumers would get that. That, you know, you'd be looking at two printers, one costs $50, one $400, and you might just say, well, I'm going to take the $50 printer, even though it would end up costing you $800 over those 2 years.
But it turns
out humans are economically kind of smart and they figured it out. So.
Well, I walk in when I first started buying printers, they say, what's the cheapest ink cartridge you got?
Exactly.
I point those out, and I'd go, I'll buy that printer.
Yeah, always inquire about the cost of consumables, and particularly on inkjet, the ink cartridges.
Yeah, well, the only question I have about it is that we bought, I think it was the second from the top, the 4500, and there's a 4550, I believe.
Yeah, we have two 4550s.
Right, then I think we're the one below. It's like a $400 model.
Mm-hmm.
But my curiosity is, I got it and we put it in there, and there was just I think it's that one. It doesn't have like my ones I have at the office were the Workforce 3640s, 3620s.
Yeah,
and they're great printer. The user interface is fantastic. You got your Epson Connect.
The features, you should understand, so the EcoTank printers aren't all Workforce printers, for instance. So there are a broad range of EcoTank printers. Some of them, the lower cost ones, don't have all, you know, the feature set is different. They don't have all the features of the more expensive ones. They're not all, for instance, Workforce printers.
But why is that? What was this?
Well, they wanted to offer EcoTank. No, but Epson makes a bunch of printers. They make home printers. They make, you know, work group printers. They make, so they wanted to offer EcoTank across a broader line than just the Workforce Pros. But if you want a Workforce Pro, and there's certain things you get like the Precision Core engine and all that, you need to get that higher, you know, the more, little more expensive one, the one up from the one you got. I have a feeling, in order to get those features. What features missing that you like?
Well, like Epson Connect, I don't think is on the one I have.
Yeah, that may be a Workforce Pro feature, right?
Yeah, but as far as taking that chipset out, is that a big deal? I mean, you can go to Costco and buy a $99 Workforce 3640.
I know, isn't that weird? I don't. Yeah, I'm not sure. I really don't. I don't have an insight into how they engineered this, or maybe it is just marketing. I don't know that part. I'll ask them.
Yeah.
I'll ask them. You know, what's the rationale behind the line? But I would suggest, and you know, anytime you see a company with a broad product line like Epson, lots of different ones, there's going to be slight differences between all of them, not merely in price point, but in features. And you've got to really make sure that the features you want are available in that particular printer that you're looking at.
But to have something like an endless ink, you know, not endless.
I know.
It's a great. And have it in a 3640 would just be brilliant. I mean, if they offered that, I'd buy a dozen.
Well, and I got the Workforce Pro myself because I like the Epson Connect, the ability to print anywhere to anywhere. It works, you know, I can print from my iPad, my phone, I can print to Google Cloud.
Beautiful.
All of that stuff is fantastic. But it's like saying, well, I bought this printer, it doesn't have Wi-Fi. Well, yeah, because you bought the printer without Wi-Fi. You have to look at what features they put in there.
I understand that. They are just like a car or anything else you buy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but Epson
Connect, forward,
I agree with you. Like, get the Epson Connect because if you think you're going to want to print wirelessly or print from the internet, that is a really nice feature.
Oh, man, it's when I found that out.
I'll tell you how I use it. I love it that I can scan to the cloud. So a lot of times I've rarely scanned documents unless somebody says I need a copy of that paper.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But so what I can do with the 4550 is I put it, and it has a scanner. I put the thing and scan it. Instead of scanning it to my computer and let it take up space there, I'm sharing it. So I scan it to the cloud. I get that link, and then I have it shared instantly. And it's really, for me, it's a better way to do it. So but some people don't want that. They don't want to pay for that, right?
So yeah, $99 for what has it all.
Well, that's an interesting question.
That's the only thing that kind of perplexed me about the whole thing. When I went and started looking at it, I was like, wow, I have one of the top-of-the-line work.
Oh, yeah, I know. I see what you're saying. Why is that not included? Well, yeah, that's a good question.
I don't know. I was just curious if you had somewhere. Maybe you can just, maybe they're listening, or maybe you can drop it.
They are listening. They're listening right now because you said the word Epson. I guarantee you they're listening like with eagle ears to hear what you say. They're very, you know what? Like any, yes. And like anybody who's really a good business in the consumer and dealing with consumers, you got to listen to your customers and respond to them. I don't think the EcoTank would exist if it weren't for customers saying, we want continuous ink. And they probably went out and they looked and they saw people like you buying these third party continuous ink supplies. And you know, it gets all over the place. It's a mess. And saying, well,
it's a mess, and it doesn't print the same as their cartridges do. I've noticed a huge difference. The EcoTank is a fantastic printer.
Yeah.
But when you put a CIS system in a high-end Epson, it's not near the quality.
So this was smart. Epson said, well, clearly there's a market. People are doing this at great expense. Although in the long run, again, it's expensive up front, but then it's cheap in the long run. We should probably make that available on some. And they don't, by the way, not all printers are EcoTank. They still make plenty of printers that aren't. They have plenty.
Oh, yeah. I noticed
so,
that. Yeah.
So it's, they're just trying to serve every, conceivable market or every market that would be a good market for them. And I think this was, independent of them buying advertising, I pat them on the back for this. I think that's really showing that they did listen to customers and they're trying to give customers something they want. I know a lot of photographers used continuous ink systems on their Epsons for years because they printed so many photographic prints. It was a good way for them to save money. But I think
you can buy 4 gallons of ink.
Yeah.
Ink
costs more than blood for some, not for Epson, but for some of these other guys. It literally, you could buy a pint of blood for less than a pint of inkjet ink.
I know.
That's crazy.
If you're going with a dye or a pigment, you can buy the dye and you can buy the pigment.
Right. Right.
You can't make them.
Anyway, I'm sorry that you didn't get what you want, but if it's not too late, turn it back in and get the one you want, because I agree, Epson Connect is a very you get an email address that you can mail documents to. It's just, there's some really nice features to it. I think it's really cool. And again, I'll say it again, because we try really hard not to confuse advertising with editorial content. And so I'll say it again, Epson is an advertiser. We are grateful to them for being an advertiser. But from an editorial point of view, I don't take that into account. And what I'm saying is my own personal opinion, independent of that. It's hard to separate those two sometimes, but I do my best because I think you deserve, frankly, my objective point of view. It's one of the reasons we do turn down a lot of advertisers. I won't do advertisements for a lot of companies because I don't feel like I can do an ad for the company and then be honest with you, right? It's one of the reasons I like Epson as an advertiser. Longtime user. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. Let's hear from you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 888 Ask Leo, the phone number. We're talking about computers and technology and the changing world all around us. And Jay's on the line from Providence, North Carolina. And I thought we'd talk to him right now. Hi, Jay.
Hey, Leo. I just wondering, what are some low-cost routers I can use only as hardware firewalls?
Ah! So you want a portable router, a travel router?
It doesn't really matter. I got mostly desktop stuff.
Okay, you want to use it at home.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my friend Steve Gibson is really a fan of a router from Ubiquiti that is super powerful and super flexible. It's only $50. So now $50 is normally, a Linksys router, for instance, is $50 or $40. That's kind of considered a really cheapy But this, what is it called? I can never remember. Edge router, that's it. The Edge router from Ubiquiti, and they make several of these, but you can find them on Amazon. Now, it's not Wi-Fi. Did you want Wi-Fi?
No, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, this is, if you're doing wired, this is definitely the way to go. It's the Ubiquiti Edge Router X. And I think that's a four-porter. They have eight and more ports if you need it, or you could just buy an inexpensive switch and use the four-port. But it's configurable. Now, you got to be a geek because you're using the web interface to configure it, and it is very, sophisticated. He recommends it because, he has this crazy idea. Actually, it's not so crazy. But your Internet of Things devices are real security risks, and some of them really are, because not merely that some bad guy can log into them and use them against you, but that they are a gateway into your network. And so his suggestion, if you're going to put, all sorts of devices on your internet, is that you isolate them. You put them on an isolated network. And normally that would take not one, not two, but three different routers in a very complicated setup to have a separate, virtual LAN for your IoT devices. But you could do that all with Ubiquiti Edge Router X in software. It has allows you to set up VLANs. It's very sophisticated. So if you're looking for something super powerful that provides, absolutely a firewall, it's got, I believe, I remember Steve saying it, it has an actual firewall, a stateful packet inspection firewall built into it. This is a very good choice.
Speaking of Internet of Things, you wouldn't happen to know if they make any kind of open source firmware for dash cams, will you?
Open source firmware for dash cams. Does not ring a bell, but maybe somebody in the chat room does. So you have a camera and you want to kind of make your own?
Well, I got a Roadhawk HD, and the thing has too much of a Rube Goldberg feel.
Well, I'm sure an open source solution would be a little Rube Goldberg-y as well. I don't know. Let's open that question up to the floor. Chat room, maybe we'll know, irc.twit.tv. Maybe somebody listening will call 8888-ASK-LEO. Worst case, somebody listening after the fact can go to our website, techguylabs.com. And that's where you can not only read questions, answers, see the links, for instance, a link to the Ubiquiti Edge Router X and all of that, but you can add comments. And so if somebody's listening and says, yes, what I'd love to find is some sort of a project to build your own dash cam. It seems like I've seen that on Hackaday or somewhere. Build your own. Oh, look at that. Chat room has come through. Thank you, PDO. I don't know if he did a Google search or knew off the top of his head. But at openhub.net, there is a source code for something called Dashcam. Good name, right? That is a Raspberry Pi based, or you could use a BeagleBone based Dashcam. It's the software to build your own. Now, if you think your current one is a kludge, this is going to look really, really kooky. But you can do it yourself. And there's something cool about. You may not make something as great as a refined, well-designed commercial product, but when you do it yourself, you have total control, and you know how it's done. It's a great learning project. AK400 saying the Edge Router X, which I'm seeing on Amazon for $52, is $49 at Newegg, so boy, that's a good price. This is a four-port gigabit router. With I have one and I haven't set it up yet, but Steve, who is our security guru, he hosts our podcast called Security Now, just raves about these. And it is a very powerful router, not wireless, not Wi-Fi. You'd have to add Wi-Fi capability to this. But you know what you could do? And in fact, this is kind of what I do right now. Is you could have this router connected to your cable modem or your DSL modem to your internet access, and then take one of those ports and attach it to a Wi-Fi access point in bridge mode. And in fact, that'd be even more secure, right? So yeah, this is a advanced, this is Black Diamond stuff. This is an advanced topic, but always glad to take those questions too. Kathy in Laverne, California, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Kathy.
Leo. I was hoping you could recommend the best metal detector for gold under $1,000.
That I don't know. That's a good question. I do not know. Are you panning for gold?
Oh, yeah.
On the beach, or where are you going?
No, up in the mountains, up by Yosemite.
You know, I'm going to go to my favorite site for consumer electronics reviews. I don't know if they'll have a metal detector. The site is called The Wire Cutter, and I highly recommend it anytime I'm thinking about buying something.
Okay.
I don't see a metal detector review there, though, but I'm going to call those guys at The Wire Cutter and say, why don't you? They have the best garden trowel.
Well, and it's gone so high technology.
Yeah. Well, it isn't really. You know, a metal detector is actually pretty simple. Somebody has says if you do a Google search, this is ironic. Somebody in our chat room says just do a Google search for best gold metal detector for under $1,000. You'll get to bestunder1000.com, and they recommend the Fisher F75. Now, this is not me. This is this is a website, but. You could read these reviews. Sometimes I don't always trust these kinds of websites because sometimes these directories are paid for placement. You know, that Fisher, it's conceivable Fisher said to them, hey, you know, we'd like to be number one. But actually, this looks pretty legit. And what you will get is kind of information about it. This is an expensive choice, the Fisher F75. But then there's also the Garrett AT Pro. And the Fisher Gold Bug 2. I wonder, would you ever find enough gold to justify that? I mean, I guess that's the thought, right? I'm going to spend $1,000 for this, but I'm going to find $2,000 in gold. I don't know. We got gold coming up. Solid gold from Chris Marquardt. He's our photo guy. He'll be joining us in just a bit with some digital photography tips just for you, and we'll take more of your calls too. 888-ASK-LEO, 888-827-5536. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. You love Rocket Mortgage, don't you? If you're in the market for buying or refiing, Rocket Mortgage is such a boon from the best lenders in the country, Quicken Loans. They decided, hey, we're Quicken Loans. We can do something no one else can do. We can make an online product, a loan approval process that is entirely online so that people don't have to come in. They don't have to bring paperwork. They can do it all online. And Rocket Mortgage was born. I like going to the website on Rocket Mortgage. Let me refresh the page. You can see it. The rocket launches. There it is. Whoa, boom. I'm sorry. I'm easily amused. But I have to say, it's about time there was a way to get a loan. Last time we bought a house about 3 years ago, it took us 6 weeks, lots of paperwork, lots of trips to the loan office. We ended up going on vacation and still having to fax them stuff. It was crazy. When it comes to the decision of choosing a mortgage lender, that's a big decision. You want to work with someone you can trust, someone who has your best interests in mind. And with Rocket Mortgage, you're going to get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. Because it's computers, it's fast, it's easy. You can literally do it from the comfort of your couch on your phone or your tablet. And you have sliders. You have functionality that you just can't get on paper. You can adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time. Make sure you get the solution just right for you. Whether you're looking to buy or refi, you can get a custom mortgage solution in minutes with Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Visit quickenloans.com/techguy. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. I love this. You got the video on here. There's a couple at an open house, and they literally apply for the loan online at Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/techguy. And can show the realtor the approval. Hey, you know, I like this open house. Are you doing that today? Big open house day, right? I like this place. Maybe we should buy this. Well, let me just show them. We're approved in minutes. Visit quickenloans.com/techguy. Rocket Mortgage. We thank them and Quicken Loans for their support of the Tech Guy Show. What are we doing today, Mr. Marquardt?
And talking about shooting people.
Okay. I wish I'd known that. That would have been a great
photographing tease. People.
Yeah. Mark, you know, I some photographers are sensitive about using shoot as a verb.
I know. Well, the whole language of photography is very violent.
Yeah. So my friend Bruce Dale, who is a National Geographic photographer, and one of the people like you and Bruce who do people are really good at making people feel comfortable in front of the lens. And he never says take a picture. He says make a picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he's very thoughtful about that because he doesn't want to say, I'd like to shoot you. And he doesn't, but he also doesn't say, I'd like to take a picture because that implies taking something. He says,
kind of depends on who you have in front of the camera. Right. I mean, there are certain people who can easily take that and who you can make fun about that with.
Yeah.
But I try to sense out, I try to feel out what people are like and what they will find okay and what they won't. But yeah, making a picture, I think that's a very good way to put
it. Isn't that sweet? Bruce is so amazing. Right? Yes. He was on that Tasmania photography adventure I did with Mikkel Olin, and I learned so much from him, watching him work. I'll never forget going, we went out to this lake. He told me to get all this really right stuff, which I did. I got a really right stuff. I didn't know there's a standard called ARCA for this.
ARCA Swiss.
Yep. Yeah. So the connectors on the Peak Design bag are ARCA compatible. So the really right stuff plate that I got so that I could quickly get it on my monopod or my tripod is compatible. So I can slide that in because it's ARCA compatible. And in fact, the Peak Design say a lot of people with ARCA, there's a lot of slop. They say, but you can trust really right stuff because they're very carefully.
Well, and the thing is the ARCA stuff doesn't have to be too close in the tolerances because the way you connect them is usually you have a screw or a lever that kind of puts these two parts really close together. And
I don't really
there's quite a bit of wear in there.
You know, the whole point on this Peak Design is it's like you click your 5D Mark IV into this thing and you're carrying it like that. I really don't want to do that.
That makes you look like a cowboy.
Yeah, and it's, it's dangerous.
Yeehaw!
All you have to do is whack something with the lens and you get $1,000 down.
Yeah. Well, I'm preparing for, but we talked about this last week, too much gear, so I get this R-strap double thing that
love
has
the
two,
R-strap.
Two straps, one left, one right, and you have the cameras, two cameras dangling on both sides. So, it's going to be, I know. I'm not going to do this at home. I will do this while in Russia.
But you want to look like, you're really serious and you're on the,
It's not about the look. It's actually about the comfort, It's about the accessibility.
I like slings, and that's why I like the R-strap. Because I like having the camera on my hip. And being able to pull it up like that is really a great way to go. It
and you know when I only have one camera?
Yeah.
Sorry. When I have only one camera with me, I have it in my hand. I don't really have much of a strap on it.
Or a shoulder strap and like this. But you wear them around your neck, especially these DSLRs, and you're going to have bad back pain and neck pain.
Yeah. I'm very prone to that. So it doesn't really work for me.
All right. Be with you in 30 seconds.
Absolutely.
That magic music means once again, it's time for Chris Marquardt, Photo Man, our digital photography guru, host of the Tips from the Top Floor podcast, a leader of many a wonderful workshop in photography, which you can find at discoverthetopfloor.com. And he joins us every week to help us get better images. You're about to go to Siberia. Wow. I'm impressed. Uh-oh. Did I lose your audio? Chris, did you mute yourself? Oh. Hello? Oh, I was just talking to him a second ago in the break. Let's see. They're messing with the buttons in the control room. Oh, including hanging up on him. Chris this week wants to talk about shooting people. Maybe that's why. No.
Three.
There. Talk to me.
Well, this sound works, but it sounds horrible.
Yeah, that's your laptop. You sound like you're a mile away. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened. We had a nice connection. We were having. Why is it the tech guy has more tech difficulties than anybody else? You know what? I'll tell you why. Because we try things no one else would dare try. We're talking to Chris via Skype in Germany. of all.
Should we try again in a few minutes?
Yeah, you want to call back and we'll figure it out. All right. Meanwhile, I'll take another call. That's easy to do. And Chris will come back and tell us about shooting people. Actually, we were talking before the break, or during the break, I should say, before we put him on the air and his microphone didn't work, about how I know photographers don't like to say, I'm going to shoot pictures. It sounds violent. So I know photographers who say, I'm going to take pictures. And then I have a friend who's a National Geographic photographer and one of the best photographers that I've ever seen for working with people, you know, not models, but just people on the street, you know, saying, hey, would you mind? And he says, make a picture. He said, would you mind if I make a picture? Oh, that's really great. And he really knows how, his name is Bruce Daly, really knows how to work with him. So I'm going to try to say, instead of shooting a picture, I'm going to say, make a picture, create a photograph. Create sounds a little bit highfalutin too. Let's go back to the phones. We're working on getting Chris back. Meanwhile, Kurt's on the line from Calabasas, California. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I really enjoy your show, and even try to get my 16-year-old twin boys to listen upon occasion.
Are they geeky? Are they interested in this stuff?
It's hard to tell. It's that transition.
Yeah.
Age, so we keep working on it.
You know, we have a 14-year-old, and he really likes to play video games. He likes to do stuff with computers, but I'm really trying to transition him to creating stuff as opposed to consuming stuff.
Mm.
I'm sure you're in the same boat where, you know, it'd be great, boy, for these kids to know how to use this stuff at a higher level, you know?
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah. Anyway, what can I do for you?
Well, I have a MacBook Pro, Retina 13, which is a late 2013 model. I guess Kim has the same model.
Nice, very nice laptop.
2.4 gigahertz i5 running Mavericks. So two questions. One is, first of all, the RAM memory usage has increased over time. I do use the computer a lot more, but it seems to be worse when running certain websites, probably, you know, tied to Firefox. But
how much RAM is on that thing? How much RAM is on it?
Eight gigabytes.
Yeah, that should be enough. So, people sometimes pay too much attention to things like this. Like, you're obviously watching some sort of resource monitor saying, well, how much RAM is being used? And a good operating system, a well-designed operating system, will use all the RAM and then release it when it's needed by other processes. You know, why would you want 2 gigs of RAM just sitting there not doing anything? You've got it. Use it. So I wouldn't worry too much about how much RAM is being used. On the other hand, if you notice you're loading a photo or an application and things get really sluggish, that's when you start to worry.
And that sort of has been the case. Using the internet, I would see, oh, gosh, we're down to like 10 megabytes. And then
but that's what's you're talking about RAM, not storage, right? Not disk storage, but actual physical memory.
That's correct.
Yeah. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
A well-designed operating system has, and OS X is a very well-designed operating system, has a memory manager that's independent of the applications. It's part of the operating system. And it kind of acts as a train conductor, making sure. But you want to use all the resources you have. Programs running out of RAM obviously run much faster than if they're running off disk. But the way it's handled in a modern operating system is programs will allocate memory and at some point, if the memory manager, the conductor, sees other programs needing memory, or worse, instead of using RAM, starting to use disk storage in the same way, which really slows things down, they'll say, look, you got to use less memory. Chrome, for instance, are you using Chrome instead of Safari?
No, it would be Firefox for the most
part. Oh, Firefox is notorious for being a RAM hog.
Yes.
So using Safari might help in that situation, but I don't see a problem with Firefox using RAM unless it doesn't release it when another program needs it. And the symptom of that is not the meter that shows how much RAM's available, but your machine slowing down. And the reason it slows down is because that other program that needs memory can't get it back from Firefox and then has to start using swap space, disk space instead of RAM. And, of course, disk is much slower than RAM.
Yes.
So it does that instead of crashing. I mean, I can't get RAM, I'm going to crash. You don't want it to do that. So it uses disk space. But you will tell because your machine will feel very sluggish. Firefox used to be terrible for RAM usage.
Mm.
They've improved. I presume you're using the latest Firefox, right?
I believe so.
Yeah. It was my impression. I actually prefer to use Chrome or Safari on the Mac, but it was my impression that Firefox had fixed its bad ways and was being much less RAM, hoggy. But okay. But maybe it is still piggy, and if it is, switch to a different browser.
That's an option.
Yeah, there's nothing that Firefox does really that you can't do on other browsers, right? Is there anything that you have to have Firefox for?
No, I don't believe so.
Yeah.
The second question.
Also, by the way, and Emily the Strange is saying this in her chat room, which is absolutely true. If you've got extensions running, you might want to check those. Sometimes they can be the hogs, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I would say for the best browser on Macintosh for battery and RAM usage, for resource usage, is Apple's own Safari. It's really tuned for Mac OS.
All right, that's good to know. The second question has to do with upgrading this machine to Sierra. I've talked to many people at Apple. Most of them say, hey, if it works, don't do it. But, for example, I can't upgrade Microsoft anymore because it wants to use the latest operating.
So Apple will only let you go as far as they think is appropriate. So don't force it, but if it will upgrade, if it offers that upgrade and you can do it, then do it.
Is it such, though, that as years have gone past, say, like Windows systems, as they introduced new operating systems, they used more and more of the machine, and it kind of required...
No, that's true, but they won't let you upgrade if your machine is not capable.
Right, but so, it still should run just as fast?
Yeah, sometimes faster.
Huh.
Because they sometimes improve things as well. You know what would really speed up your machine? If you're experiencing sluggishness, and that is not an old machine in the scheme of things. That is a fast machine. It could be the hard drive itself. Now, it's an SSD, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
All right. So it's less likely a problem. But sometimes hard drives, if they get flaky, what happens is you're trying to read a file, and instead of reading it right away, it says nope, and it tries two or three times. If that happens enough, your whole system feels really slow, and that's not unusual. And spinning hard drives is more common than an SSDs. SSDs, either the cell works or it doesn't work generally, so you don't see these kinds of slowdowns so much with SSDs. But just in case, if you do decide to upgrade, do a clean install. Wipe the disk, back up your data, get your install disks together, wipe the disk, and reinstall everything. Almost always that speeds things up, even on a Macintosh.
Is there a way to make a full backup of what I have in case I want to go back to it? Like
every Mac user should have a program called Super Duper. It will make, on an external drive, a identical, bootable backup of your system. In fact, I keep that running all the time. Always a good thing to have. All right, we're going to get Chris Marquardt on in just a minute. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
You're out.
Can you hear me, Chris?
It seems to be Skype.
Oh, I hate Skype.
It's been doing this lately, and nothing else. The sound just drops out without any indication.
Do you just go away. And even in the settings in Skype are correct?
Of course, everything's fine. Actually, I reinstalled my entire computer a few days ago. It's a brand new machine, pretty much, including a fresh download of Skype and everything. And Skype just updated itself again, even though I told it not to.
Well, so, I think we do want the latest version. I mean,
which is fine, but the sound just cuts out. Nothing else on my system does that. I do a lot of recordings and stuff, and the sound always is on. Initially, I thought it's the audio interface, but I'm pretty sure it's Skype.
Well, that's frustrating.
Well, let's. I'm not even moving in the mouse or anything. And when it happened just now, I didn't even have touched the mouse. Yeah. Nothing. Yeah. So.
That it was weird because, we were talking. I said 30 seconds, then you come back and they're gone. It's frustrating.
Have you ever looked into any alternatives?
We are looking into something right now, actually, that is a much more professional. Anything
WebRTC based or SIP video?
WebRTC is bad. We're not going to go to WebRTC. It's very low quality. But there is a thing that uses Comrex, commercial Comrex codecs. It's not free, but we'd pay for it for you. And I'm very intrigued by that. It uses VP8 for video, so that's open source. But
it's on the guest side. It's a software solution.
Yep, it's all software.
Okay.
Yes, please.
All right, if that works. I'm all for it.
All right, crossing my fingers. Yeah, I got to turn up the. I actually, it's funny. They tweeted me And it's just chance that I saw it, because I don't often read what's going on Twitter. I read the front page of Twitter, but I don't read the at replies. But they tweeted me, and I happened to see it, and so now I have to pursue it. I can't even remember what the name of it is. I don't know, in fact, I hope I can find it, but it was IP something. And it looked like a good Comrex-based solution. So I talked to our engineers about trying it, so
I'll be your beta tester if you want it.
Yeah, that was Bruce Dale's homepage. It was brucedale.com if you want to see his equipment stuff.
Scroll. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's got some...
Been there before.
Yeah, Bruce is... He's just a sweetheart, too.
Yes, he is.
All right, so I'm going to keep you up. I'm not modifying anything.
I'm not touching anything here. I mean, this is a brand new... This is a brand new setup here. This is just crazy. It is crazy.
We've been having a lot more trouble with Skype over the last few months, for sure.
Okay. It's probably Microsoft adding all the AR stuff into Skype for the future.
Well, it's definitely Microsoft, you know, and they're, who knows what they're mm-hmm. doing. You go through Microsoft servers, so.
It's true, yeah.
Could even be
Skype used to be peer-to-peer.
Yeah,
and
that's when we were happiest with it. When it works, it works great. Past. I mean, you're calling us from Germany. You sound good. You look good. It's as good as a satellite picture.
Yep.
There's no people say, "Oh, use Google or no." WebRTC is not as good. It's just not as good. It's easier. It's fine for casual use. FaceTime, same thing. So. We need something better, not worse.
Right.
I think we might have found it because it uses Comrex codecs are very good. They're proprietary. Very good codecs.
I never heard of Comrex.
It's used by radio a lot. I use Comrex to...
oh, I see.
Not for this. We use Zephyr, but...
is that the codecs that used to go over ISDN?
Yeah, they were really designed originally for POTS use. And so they're all very robust. Here we go. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Oh, we're going to try again. See if we can get the Skype gods to cooperate. Chris Marquardt, he's our photo guy, helps us each week get better pictures. I love digital photography. It's one of my – it's probably my number one hobby. It's because I'll tell you what, for a guy like me, it's great because not only does it use my visual side, my artistic side, but there's some great gear involved. And I like gear.
Yep. Photography has always been this interesting mixture of technology and creativity. Yeah. And if you have both of those sides in you, photography is just the ideal thing to do.
And for
a lot of geeks out there, photography is a good way to get in touch with that creative side of them that they might not really have, but to kind of develop it and to work on it. It's a good motivator for that, especially when it lets you play with gadgets.
Well, so. and it gives you an excuse to interact with people, which, believe it or not, I'm pretty shy. And so one of my biggest challenges with photography is taking pictures or shooting, as you say, people.
As we established earlier, photography has a very kind of violent lingo around it. So taking pictures of people, that's the topic. I've always get this question. Why is it so hard to take good pictures of people?
Well, I'll tell you one thing I have a problem with. They pose. As soon as you say, can I take your picture? They turn, they face you, and they smile.
Or they are not patient with you because as a photographer, if you want to do a good job, you kind of have to spend some time. I just did a photo session with a model and it took like 3 hours and we did several locations and things. And a still life is just more patient. You know, people get annoyed. Architecture and landscapes just don't. They will just sit there for you.
True.
So the other thing is what can you compare your people photography too. You see a lot of this heavily retouched stuff in the media, in magazines, in commercials. And if you take pictures of people, there's a good chance they won't be as crisp, as good looking. And that's not the fault of the people in front of the camera. And that's often not the fault of the photographer. There's a lot of retouching going on there. So that's another thing that kind of gets people a bit discouraged when they start trying to take pictures of people. another reason why it's so hard to take good pictures of people is that as a photographer, you're often intimidated to enter someone else's kind of personal space, you know? I mean, next time you're in an elevator, try to look in another passenger in the eye. There are some social norms that we have a hard time breaking, you know? So, and the same is true with photography. You kind of have to intrude into their space a bit. And then often I see people not taking enough time because you have to take time. You have to develop a, kind of a feeling for what the other person is like. And when I do a photo session with someone, I always ask them, is there anything you don't like about yourself or anything you especially like about yourself? And then you will hear interesting things. I mean, most people don't like their chin, for example. Some people love their noses, some hate them. So as long as you know this, you can kind of adjust to that. You can adapt to your photography to that. And for example, if someone has a very big nose, it will probably look nicer if you shoot it straight on and not in profile. So just having that understanding between you and the person in front of the camera is going to help you. And then it's a thing you have to work. You can't give up. You have to practice and you have to establish this atmosphere of trust. By the way, that display on the back of your camera, that is an amazing tool when it comes to building trust. When you take photos of someone, show them what you do. Give them that photo. Show them at least the good ones that you took, and establish a base of trust there.
That makes a big difference. People, I've seen that happen. When they see it and it looks like a good picture, they go,
because they're usually not used to that. They're used to some weird snapshots taken with a smartphone. And the smartphones are good, but you know, the situation might not be the right one. Or you have some weird stuff in the background, some trees growing, tree branches growing out of your ears. It doesn't usually happen when you make it a really kind of a specific photo session as opposed to just a snapshot. And then there are a few tricks that you can use to make another person look good. I mean, we just talked about the chin. I don't like if I have two or three chins on a photo. So there are ways to kind of lift the head a bit, stretch it out a bit, maybe shoot from a slightly higher angle, not from straight up as in the average, let's say, Facebook avatar, but just from slightly above the eye line, that will certainly make things a bit less, well, make the chin look nicer. Noses we just brushed on. If someone doesn't like their nose, a photo straight on a long nose is going to make this nose look smaller than a profile. Eyes is a thing. People often think their eyes look too small on photos. So you can work. You know what really works well? If you tell someone, okay, close your eyes and on three, open them. And then you go one, two, three, they open their eyes. And at that moment, they open their eyes just a little bit bigger than they would usually do. And that's when you shoot. That trick has worked a lot in the past. What else can we do? The forehead, especially people who are... What's the term? Follically challenged?
They don't have any hair.
Well, you know, the thing is, I mean, I look at my hairline receding slowly.
Yeah,
so,
me too.
If you take a picture of someone and you cut right under that hairline, so the only thing you see on the photo is a forehead right up to the edge of the picture, the viewer will in their mind kind of extend that forehead up beyond that edge of the frame. So if there is a hairline included, that's a very important tip. So the hair kind of stays there and is visible in the shot.
Some years ago, I interviewed one of the best street photographers in the world. His name is Bruce Davidson. And he's famous for taking pictures of gangs, of going into the New York City subway. And I asked him, you know, well, what do you do? He said, well, there's you know, three things you can do. He says, sometimes you just want to, there's the mood. You don't want to interrupt it by asking. So you just take the picture and then you apologize afterwards. You say, the mood was so great. It was so great. But let me show you. And you hope. He says, if that doesn't work, he always carried with him, I thought this was interesting, a little booklet of his portfolio. He had pictures of his laminated, and he would say, well, I'm a photographer. I do street pictures. Here's some examples. And the same as showing the back of your camera, kind of reassured people, oh, well, this guy's not just a weirdo. He's actually, you know, a good photographer. And he said if those didn't work, his third choice was just to run like hell.
Smile and walk on.
Be prepared to just walk away as fast as you as your little feet can carry you.
Right.
And given that he was often taking pictures in dangerous neighborhoods of dangerous people, I can understand. I can understand that advice. He got some. He's very famous for his amazing pictures of, you know, some scary people. But they're all. It's funny because they're great pictures. They're very sympathetic.
Oh, it's often the people that you would be a bit scared of, like someone with lots of tattoos or lots of piercings, and those are often the people who are most happy for their picture to be taken because they want to be seen. They're out there to be seen.
Exactly. If you have a lot of tattoos, they wanted you to honor that, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm just a scaredy cat. I just always choose run like hell. That's
well, that the kind of street photography you're talking about is often easier if you do it with another photographer. If you're two, that kind of gives you more of a feeling of safety, and then you will very soon find out. Well, depending on where you are, but you usually will in bigger cities, often find out that people are quite happy with their pictures.
And I like taking pictures of people. I want to see them, and I want to see them up close. I want to see their faces. There's just something to me about pictures of humans that is inherently more interesting than landscapes or architecture. I mean, those are great, and I've seen, you know, you take some beautiful landscape photos, but I love it when you get those pictures of those children in Nepal, and they're so beautiful and warm. And
even in my landscape shots, I try to incorporate people if at all possible, especially when it's somewhere that people don't really have a reference for. Like in Siberia on Lake Baikal, these huge, huge plains of ice and these huge shards of almost glass shards, like 10 feet high sometimes. If you have a person in that, if you include a person in that, you'll have a reference.
Well,
you'll
all
of a sudden
scale.
Yes, you will. You'll all of a sudden have that scale reference. You will, and people will go, "Wow, that's actually bigger than I thought."
Now you're off next week for Siberia. We're going to record some segments ahead of time, so you'll still be on the show. How long are you going to be in Baikal?
Well, it's a Siberia tour with a 4-day Moscow segment at the end.
Oh, fun.
And in total, I'll be gone for 2 weeks.
I'll be looking forward to your pictures of the Russian people. They're beautiful people. Fascinating. Have fun,
yes,
Chris. Discoverthetopfloor.com. That one's booked up, but he's got many more coming up. If you want to find a photo workshop, that's the place to go. Nice.
You're out.
We rebooted, and it all worked.
Well.
And I'll mention the assignment when we come back.
The break assignment is still on, yep. So you will be off here in
1 hour.
In 1 hour. Okay, so I'll be here.
We'll call you back in 1 hour.
I'll be here, no problem.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
See you then.
Bye-bye. Oh, I love that. He always inspires me. I always want to go take more pictures after I talk to Chris. And then I go out and I get shy again. And hey, our show today brought to you by 23andMe. Valentine's Day is Tuesday, and right now 23andMe has a special deal for you and your honey. Wouldn't you like, I mean, I think this is the greatest thing ever, to know your genetic code. You can do it, and you'll get $20 off if you order before Valentine's Day at 23andMe.com. Now, what's nice about 23andMe is easy. I did this a couple of years ago, I think. And all you have to do is spit into a vial. That's enough DNA for them to do their complete analysis. You can get their ancestry service and learn how your DNA breaks out across 31 populations worldwide. Find out where your ancestors lived more than 500 years ago. And even go farther back over thousands of years. Trace parts of your ancestry to the maternal and paternal haplogroups. Would you like to know if there's any Neanderthal in you? Because I am proud to say, maybe it's not a good thing, I have less Neanderthal in me than a lot of people. I don't know. But this is one reason, by the way, people love a 23andMe subscription, why it's a great Valentine's Day gift, because everybody loves to talk about themselves, right? And what is more intimate, what is more you than your DNA? Here's my ancestry report. Whether my earwax is wet or dry, that's chromosome 16. Here's the ancestry composition for me. Yours will be different, and this is a fun thing to know. 39% Irish and British. But if I go back farther in time, see, this timeline is so cool. French and German, going back to my great-great-grandfather. Scandinavian, Italian. If I go back, believe it or not, to somewhere between 1690 and 1810, Ashkenazi Jewish and Iberian. That is awesome. I love having all this stuff. 23andMe will also let you download your full genetic code so if you can do your own software analysis of it or hand it off to somebody else. It'll find relatives. This is awesome. It found a second cousin that is for sure a second cousin because his last name is the same as my grandma's maiden name. Isn't that awesome? 23andMe.com. And, of course, with 1 million genotyped customers worldwide, this list grows all the time as people do it. It's why I encourage everybody in my family to do it because I want them all, you know, if they're all in there, they're going to find more ancestry. You also get wellness information if you choose. Things about, you know, caffeine consumption. I'm less likely a deep sleeper, but I do have fast twitch muscles. I should have been a sprinter. Things like that. Go to 23andMe.com right now. If you buy before Tuesday, before Valentine's Day, you'll get $20 off. 23andMe, 23andMe.com. It's also, you know what? This is a great thing for learning about genetics and what your genes are. And of course, your privacy is 100% guaranteed. It's all you can even if you don't want to share, you know, with relatives and stuff or find relatives, you can say, no. No one can see this but me. Now, once you get your father and mother in there, you learn even more, which I love. It's awesome. 23andMe.com. Kind of romantic. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, and all that jazz. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number, the website. Good place to keep track of because that's where you can find links to everything we mentioned. We can find the audio and the video of the show after the fact, the questions, the answers. It's all there. And it's free. There's no sign up. Tech Guy Labs. .com. I mentioned smartphones and smartwatches almost every show as one of the topics we cover. And certainly smartphones, that's the computer everybody uses nowadays. I mean, it's just ubiquitous, and it is probably the computer you use the most. But what about smartwatches? This has just been kind of a stutter step category. It just hasn't taken off. Apple said that the holiday buying quarter, their last quarter, was the most successful, the largest revenue ever for the Apple Watch, but they didn't say how much or how many watches were sold. Most analysts agree that the number one fitness device sold is from Fitbit, and even Fitbit's struggling. They just laid off people. It's a category that seems to have its adherence. I mean, there are people who just love their smartwatches, but I think most of us kind of look at it and scratch our heads and go, well, that's nice, but not $350 nice. Most recently, the most bad news, besides the Fitbit layoffs and the fact that Pebble went out of business, was acquired by Fitbit, was that Motorola, which made the most popular Android smartwatch, the Moto 360, quit that business as well. Said, not a good business. However, on Friday, Google released the new version of Android Wear, its watch operating system, Android Wear 2.0, and shipped with the LG. LG made the watch. Two new watches, the LG Style and the LG Sport, running Android Wear 2.0. So, of course, it's my job. I ran out to AT&T, was selling them, Best Buy, Google, I think, is now selling it on their store online. But the only place I could get it on Friday was my local AT&T store. I got the only one they had in stock. And it wasn't exactly a line out the door to buy it. This is the one I'm holding is the LG Sport. That's the bigger of the two and the more capable. $350. So it's the same price as the base model of the Apple Watch. Unlike the Apple Watch, though, the band is not interchangeable. You can only use it with its existing band, which is a kind of a ugly gray. The watch itself is steel gray. There's no choice there either. But It is very capable. Inside, it's got a GPS radio. It's got a telephone. It's got LTE capability. So you could actually make and receive phone calls without a phone. It'll let you make and receive phone calls. It's just on the watch itself. It's also, and most people, I think, use watches these days, a fitness watch. It has a heart rate monitor, which is, of course, an important fitness feature. Let me take the plastic off of that. It has, and the heart rate monitor is, you know, okay. It's not as good as the Apple Watch. Nor is it as good as the Fitbit. And it is a big, clunky, heavy watch, really thick. I think you'd have to be a big-wristed fella to think this watch looks good on you. They have improved Android Wear in a number of ways, a lot of nice new features. But it begs the question, how much of a market? It's not even very comfortable because in order to do the GPS and the LTE and the barometer and the thermometer and all the different sensors in here, they've actually had to incorporate part of the watch's hardware in the band itself. So the band is very rigid about halfway down your wrist. That's why you can't get a replaceable band. The band's a big part of the watch. It's screwed in there. And that means the band is not very flexible. So this thing, well, you feel like you're on a work release from a prison, frankly. I think it probably looks a little bit like that. It's not the most attractive. And so what am I saying, bottom line? Well, at least this watch, the style's a little more attractive, but has far fewer hardware features and is a little less expensive. I can't recommend it. I can't recommend it. The Apple Watch of all the smartwatches is probably the best, but it's also, you know, more expensive than anybody else. And if really fitness is your main goal, I think the Fitbits are pretty good. They're not attractive. The Fitbit Blaze, that's the one I use, it's kind of an ugly watch. The Surge, also inflexible, rigid, not very attractive. This is just a struggling category. Somebody in the chat room, Luddite, says, he's seeing the watch on the video. He's watching the video, says, that watch screams, I have no taste at all. Yeah, that's what I'm going for. First of all, people have stopped wearing watches. Why? Because they had smartphones that told them the time. So watch sales in general have been down. You know, Apple and Google taught us we didn't need a watch. We had a phone, and now they want us to buy watches. The other reason people buy watches is as jewelry, right? They're attractive, and they're heirlooms. A beautiful watch, very expensive. You could spend six figures on a fancy Rolex or, you know, Piaget, one of those high-end watches. But at least you can hand it down. A smartwatch has the lifespan of, like any computer, of a few years. This thing's going to be way out of date in 5 years. And it'll only be, you know, an heirloom in the sense that, look what Dad wore. It'd be an heirloom like one of those Casio calculator watches from the 80s. Remember those? They came with a little stylus to touch the buttons that were too small for your fingers. It's hard for me to recommend this. If you're a serious fitness person, you're probably going to get a watch from Garmin or Polar or one of the fitness companies that's, you know, purpose-built for running or, you know, your sport. If you're a kind of casual fitness person, as I am, I like to know my heart rate when I work out. I like to keep track of how much working out I've done. You're probably going to be happier with a Fitbit for a lot less money, although the Apple Watch is also pretty good for that. Apple Watch has a feature I like, which is that you can share your fitness with others. You know, they have those rings, and you're trying to fill the rings. They've made it a game. You have a ring for calories expended, time spent in high pulse rate activity, and the number of times you stood up, believe it or not. The third ring is standing. And you want to complete your rings by standing 12 hours out of 24. You want to set your goal for a number of calories you want to burn, in my case, 500, how much time you want to spend working out, in my case, half an hour, but you could make it longer or shorter. And completing your rings is a game that you're kind of motivated to do. And because you're sharing it with friends, you know, they get a notification when you do well, or they don't get a notification when you don't do anything. And that's kind of we know that's a good way to get people working out. That works well on the Apple Watch. I don't see this Android Wear selling well at all. And I think before you get one, you should probably go look at it, put it on your wrist, and see how you feel about it then. You know, I haven't tried the latest Samsung Gear watches. Those look a little more attractive. Maybe they're a little more functional. Not sure. They actually make watches that can act as standalone phones like this LG Sport. I think maybe this is one of those things like disco and puffy sleeve shirts we'll look back on in years to come and go, what were we thinking? Mullets. What were we thinking? Why did we do that? Why did that seem like a good idea? Meanwhile, I can't wait to get this thing off my wrist. I gotta have to wear it for a few weeks just to give it a real. I only got it on a couple of days ago. Give it a real test, but so far underwhelmed. Not that impressive. It's nice to know. I mean, I'm looking at my watch. I can tell that I've taken 4,285 steps, and you know it's February 12th. 8888 Ask Leah. All right, enough of me talking. Let's get to the phones, get your questions, help you out a little bit with your technology. Again, the website, as I mentioned, techguylabs.com. Open, free, and no sign-up required. We'll go back to the phones and answer your calls right after this. I am Leo Laporte with a heavy wrist, the tech guy. Thanks to Mike Cozio, our musical director, picking the hits. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. Thanks to Kim Schaffer, our phone ranger, for answering the phones. And on the line right now from Diamond Bar, California, it's Karen. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
I'm so bad. I'm sorry. I do that to you every time, don't you? You're on hold, and then I go to you, and it's like, ah!
I'm in and out.
Because you've been on hold for a while. I know you are, Karen. Thank you. I'm sorry. I apologize for jumping to you, and thank you for your patience. I appreciate it. What can I do for you?
You're coming in a little bit spotty. Hopefully I'm being heard better.
You sound great. I'll shout.
Great. All right. I had a Note 3 and cried the day the screen broke.
Yeah.
I looked for replacements, and they were pretty high. And then it occurred to me that I would go to a Note 4 because the phones that I saw didn't have access to the SD drive or a replaceable battery.
Right.
And I bought one on eBay for $207.
Good
deal.
And
I was very confused by the verbiage.
Good deal.
And it came in Korean. That was the first clue.
Yeah, that's not unusual, by the way. When you buy a Samsung phone, you got to be careful because the phones that they sell are all, they're global. And so you can get a Samsung phone that is not for the American market, as you did. You got one for the Korean market. Hello.
Okay, well, I'm confused by the verbiage. I ended up returning it under much duress, and I went to AT&T and also to Best Buy to look at the phone to see what the problem was. So when I go back now to look for a phone, the verbiage is confusing. It'll say unlocked, or it'll say factory unlocked, or then it'll say unlocked for GSM. Then there's an SM, N as in Nancy, 910T. Then there's a 910X and a 910A. And Lord knows which of those I want. I currently have AT&T.
So T is for T-Mobile. Samsung makes these phones for not just many regions of the world. They also make phones for every carrier. And the difference primarily in these phones is the radios. In other words, whether they have a radio that is supported by that particular company. The frequencies AT&T uses are different than the frequencies T-Mobile uses, which are different from the frequencies Sprint uses, which are different from the frequencies Verizon uses, which are different from the frequencies used in Korea, which are different from the frequencies used in China. You understand the problem? So, in general, and this is the problem buying on eBay, because there's the additional issue of eBay buyers or sellers not necessarily being completely forthright about what you're getting. So, if you know, the safest thing, of course, would be to buy it from the carrier, because that, you know, if you buy it from AT&T, your carrier, but it's also the most expensive solution. But if you buy it from them, it's going to be the, you know, fully compatible. It'll be the AT&T version. You can find out what those letters mean with a Google search. the specs are, you know, all over the place. But the T is 910T is for T-Mobile. A is probably AT&T, although it could be Asia. You'll have to, you know, you'll have to Google those numbers. You can, and I've done, so let me, and then let me talk about unlocked, because you also asked about that. Factory unlocked means it's made not for a carrier, but for direct sales to end users. Carriers, what carriers do is when you go to AT&T and buy a phone, the phone they sell you can only be used with an AT&T SIM card and has to be unlocked before you could carry it to another carrier. Now, the good news is AT&T, as with many phone companies, will unlock it for you after you've owned the phone, it's paid in full, you've owned it for 6 months, you're in good standing, they have a set of criteria you have to satisfy. And they even have an app you could put on the phone and it'll say, no, you can't unlock it yet, or, yeah, you can unlock it, let's unlock it. At that point, you can carry it someone else. But that doesn't guarantee that the radios will work. You know, it doesn't guarantee that it is fully compatible with some other network. Generally, any phone you get for U.S. use is probably going to work with U.S. all the U.S. carriers well. It's more an issue when you get overseas. So that's unlocked, factory unlocked. If it doesn't say factory unlocked, that means maybe that it was sold as a locked phone, as with your AT&T phone, but that it was later unlocked by a third party, maybe the carrier, maybe somebody else. Maybe they did it right, maybe they didn't do it right, but it is not SIM locked. You can use it with another carrier. You kind of want factory unlocked. That, and that's probably a little more expensive. That's designed by Samsung to be sold directly to end users and used on a variety of carriers. The other thing that you have to do, if you're going to do this, if you're going to go on eBay, is carefully look at the specs for the phone you're going to buy and what radio frequencies it supports, and then look at the carrier you're going to use and see what radio frequencies it wants. Generally speaking, the only place this is going to make a difference is for data, for LTE data. Sometimes you can buy a phone that doesn't have all of the LTE frequencies that your U.S. carrier has. And in some cases, and I've had this happen to me, you'll buy a phone designed for Asia that works, in my case on T-Mobile, but doesn't have the fastest T-Mobile frequencies available. So basically, when you're buying on eBay, it's all on your shoulders to figure it out. Does that help? Is there anything else you would like to know about that? Any other terminology that's puzzling you? Hello? I guess not. You take your chance when you buy. I generally would say don't buy on eBay. I've had enough problems with eBay sellers that I kind of don't want to take a chance. Even if they indemnify it and eBay or PayPal says, oh, we'll give you your money back. You know, it's for people who don't mind a little risk. There's a little risk. I usually buy my phones from kind of better known sellers on line. For instance, there's a company called Expansys. It's a British company, E-X-P-A-N-S-Y-S. They have a U.S. store. Expansys sells, you know, from the factory phones with a variety of specs, and they tell you very clearly in the listing what radio frequencies and so forth. I'm not sure you'll probably get a better deal on eBay because eBay sellers understand they're taking a risk, so they have to give you a better deal. But when I want to buy an unlocked phone, I'll either buy it from Expansys. I'll always check Amazon to see if Amazon has its own wireless store, see if they're selling it. It's just tricky, and you got to know what you're looking for. And I don't blame you for wanting a Note 4. That was a great phone. Note 5 I really liked. The Note 7, you talked about crying when you had to, you know, retire your Note 4. I cried when I handed my Note 7 into T-Mobile. But I did. I didn't want it blowing up. But I loved that phone. And I'm really looking forward to see what Samsung does. They are going to stay with the Note name. And they are going to do, I guess, a Note 8. They'll do the next generation Note, presumably the 8. But it won't be till this fall. We'll see a Galaxy S8. Announced next month, and it might be a suitable Note replacement because they're going to have one with a 6.2-inch screen. At least that's what's rumored. That's a bigger than the Note. That's a big screen. That it'll have a stylus. So if the stylus is what you want, you're going to want to wait for the Note. But you know what? Nobody's making phones these days with removable batteries. Unfortunately, I wish they would. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, it's unfortunately tricky. And were you buying it I guess. Are you still there, Karen?
Yeah, you're coming in and out.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I turned you off on the radio because it was coming in and out, but that's all right. But we're still on. You and I are still talking. We're on the podcast. We're not on the radio. So did that give you the information you needed? Is there more you'd like to know?
Well, you know, I guess.
Yeah, see, it's coming and going.
Other language about whether to, you know, they use that. It looks like it's isn't.
If they say as is.
They'll call S-M-N, is it?
N?
And then they'll, M as in Nancy, S as in Susan, M as in mother, N as in Nancy, 9-10. And then they'll list it as an A, 9-10-A, 9-10-T, 9-10-X. And Lord knows what those refer to.
Well, I'll tell you, SM means Samsung. The 9-10 means a Note 4.
Right.
And those additional letters, so all Note 4s are SM 9-10s. But those additional letters tell you what market they're intended for. So, as I said, the T means T-Mobile. So, it means it has all the T-Mobile frequencies. But it does not mean it's carrier locked necessarily. It could have been unlocked. T-Mobile often sells unlocked phones. But often if you have, like, I think the A probably means AT&T. And chances are if you get it from AT&T, that's carrier locked. Let me see. The A, maybe Asia. You know, you just have to Google those specific numbers and see what people say.
Yeah.
But that last letter is the key to all of this, because it will tell you what market it's designed for exactly.
You mentioned going to AT&T. Do they sell old phones?
They may sell a Note 4, because remember the Note 7 was dumped. And they may have Note 5s, but they may also have Note 4s. If you can buy it new, you'd be better off than buying a used Note 4. The international Snapdragon variant is F, somebody in the chat room is telling me, and the AT&T is A. So when you see a SM N910A, that's the AT&T version of the Note 4. Does that make sense? And I've, you know, we lost her. And then there's J, you know, there's other letters which mean, well, J I think was Japan. So you have to really be careful about what you're buying. That's why I always buy it from Expansys. Expansys is always explicit about, you know, they'll tell you, oh, no, this is, you know, the Asian one or the, let's see. They're ceasing sales. Never mind. What? Okay, I take it all back. Expansys went out of business. Effective December 1st, we'll be closing our website to new orders and cease all online sales to U.S., Canadian, and Mexican websites. That's probably, I would expect the carriers putting pressure on there. But maybe not. Maybe they went out of business. I don't know. Oh, never mind. Never mind. Whoops. And I just gave him a nice plug and everything. So there's Amazon Wireless. But that's tricky too, because you may be buying it from a third party when you buy it on Amazon, right? This is the V, the Verizon variant. That is sold new on Amazon for $200. So I didn't even get into, we were talking with Kathy about, you know, figuring out which phone is right for your carrier. I didn't even, and of course, if price weren't an object, get it from your carrier. Just get it from your carrier. That's the only way to guarantee it's going to work with your carrier. But if you know what you're doing, you can shop around. I didn't even mention the difference between GSM and CDMA. They're different kinds of phone networks. Fortunately, that difference is getting less important as all the carriers worldwide move to LTE and voice over LTE, which will eliminate this old GSM CDMA distinction. But older phones like your Note 4, that's going to be a distinction you'll have to make. AT&T and T-Mobile are GSM carriers. You'll need the GSM variant of the Note 4 for them. Verizon and Sprint are CDMA carriers. You need the CDMA version of the Note 4 for them. And that's only because the Note 4 is so old. Newer phones will work on both in general. Everybody's using SIM cards. The Note 4 was a kind of the classic. I wasn't as crazy about the Note 5 because, as Kathy mentioned, you didn't have a removable battery. You didn't have SD card support. They did bring that back later, but that model was just, you know, a sealed box. And the model before it, the Note 4, in fact, I still have three or four Note 4 batteries because it had easily removed batteries. It was awesome. I think those days are, I'm sorry to say, I think those days are gone. Although had Samsung, I should point out, stuck with removable batteries in their exploding Note 7, it wouldn't have been the exploding Note 7. They could have done a recall of the battery. Probably wouldn't have had the problem at all, but if you did, you could have called a recall of the battery, and that would be that. You'd still have the phone. So sealing that battery in might have been, you know, a strategic error. They did it because consumers demanded it. We want thinner. We want more battery in a smaller space, and that means, you know, you can't have an enclosure around the battery that takes up space. But Samsung's own report about the failures of the Note 7, the reason the Note 7 exploded is because in the original Note 7, they put too much battery in too small a case. And in occasion, not all of them, but on occasion, the battery would expand and leak and short because there was just no room to grow in there. Wouldn't have been a problem. Wouldn't have been a problem on the Note 4. Worst case, the battery expands, the back pops off, and you go, this battery's bum. You bring it back, and they give you a fresh one. You don't have an explosion. 8888, ask Leah. Let's go to Springfield, Missouri, and Kenny. Hi, Kenny.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing good. I had a question about a printer. It's not an Epson. It's a Canon Image Class 244DW.
Okay. What's the problem?
I don't know. Oh, no problem. I want to know if it was a good printer. I was thinking about getting one.
The Image Class, I in the past used Canon's Pixmas and been very happy with it. I have not tried the Image Class. These are their laser printers. In general, I like laser printers. The advantage of laser printers is that the cost of consumables is low. You're not buying inkjet cartridges or inkjet ink. You're buying a toner cartridge. And what's amazing,
yeah, I don't print much.
For light printing duty, where you're printing, you know, every once in a while, a laser is also better because the heads don't get clogged. Inkjets tend to get clogged if they're not used enough. And the nice thing about these Canons, they're cheap. Canon made the engines, the laser engines that appeared in the first consumer laser printer, the Apple Laser Writer, all those years ago. They really were the kings of laser printing. So I can't say I've used the Image Class, but looking at the price and knowing that it's from Canon, I'd say that's probably a very good choice. It's black and is it black and white?
Yes, black and white. Yeah.
How much?
I've seen it for $99.
Wow. So my first laser printer, which had a Canon engine, the Apple Laser Writer, was $3,000. And not as good as the printer you're about to buy. Not as good. Yours is faster. It's probably got Wi-Fi, right? Is it wireless?
Yeah, it does the AirPrint and the
Android print. That's awesome. It's like amazing. So let's see here. Boz in the chat room says, I have a Canon Image Class color printer. I like it, but it does go through toner cartridges pretty quick, and it has a chip in it that tells it the cartridge is expired, even though he's of the opinion there's plenty of toner left. Yeah, you know, when you're replacing a toner cartridge on a laser printer, generally you're not only adding toner, well, it depends on the printer, but in some cases you're also replacing the head, the printer itself. It's actually a plate. Electrostatic plate, and that may be the chip in that cartridge is saying, well, I got to replace the plate as well as the toner cartridge. So I would trust it if it says that. You know what? I think these are great. I don't know what the cost of consumables is, but I would, if you check that, and a laser printer should be 4 or 5 cents a page. If it's that, I'd say go for it. Canon makes great printers. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Yeah, this is a deplorable, frankly, development in printer manufacturers. They put chips in their cartridges for copy protection, too, so that you can't use third-party cartridges. many have said, I have yet to see solid proof, but many have said that these chips will also prevent you from printing, even if you're not out of ink, saying, oh, you're out of ink, got to get a new cartridge, even if there's visible ink in there. I don't know if that's the case, but I've heard enough people say it, I'm starting to wonder. That's something the FTC should look into. That if that's the case, that's wrong. Richard is in Oceanside, California. He's our next caller. Hi, Richard.
Hey, Leo.
Hey, Richard.
Love your show.
Thank you, sir. What can I do for you?
Well, I want to tell you about a ransomware experience I had.
Oh, dear.
Before I do, I want to joke. You know what's worse than downloading ransomware?
What?
Having your employee download ransomware. But I was the culprit on this one.
but this is a problem now because a lot of times these what happens is you get a spear phishing email, or maybe spear phishing means targeted, or just a regular phishing email.
From FedEx.
Yeah, and it comes from somebody you deal with, maybe FedEx, but sometimes it's the IRS. Except it's not FedEx. It's not the IRS. It's not your boss. It's a bad guy posing as FedEx. Well, and then it says you got to open this PDF or got to open this attachment. You do because you don't know any better. And some of the really bad ones don't just infect your computer, but they go out over the network.
Oh, no, don't start talking like that.
And they infect all the computers on the network. Let's hope. I guess you didn't get that kind. You would know if you did. Your employees would be coming to you saying, hey, boss, I can't get into the computer.
Well, I downloaded some ransomware. I knew right when I hit that button, and my eyes, I glanced at the URL, and it was different.
For the benefit of our listeners, so it was a FedEx email.
Yeah.
And what did it say?
Oh, it said something about that they're having difficulty delivering a package.
Right. Well, you want that package. Could be something good.
Well, yeah.
And what did they tell you to do?
Hit the link or something. download the message or whatever.
Yeah, and you did, of course, because you want that package. Yeah.
That's right.
And how did you know that you had ransomware?
Oh, it's easy to know because just almost immediately up comes this screen and it talks about, you have ransomware. And
give me money if you ever want to see your data again.
And bitcoins and all this stuff. So what I did is I immediately...
Hey, Richard, hang on. This is a good place to break. I got to take a break. we'll leave you hanging. I want to find out what happened next. We will right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
You're out.
That was mean, but the network breaks come when they come, Richard. I'm sorry, but we'll be...
That's all right.
We'll be back in a couple of minutes. I want to hear the... This is a good tease. I want to hear the rest of the story.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Hang on. Yeah, great. Thank you for calling in. Yeah. Oh. And, of course, that they always are going to have something in there that psychologically makes you want to act right now without thinking, which is either fear... Fear's the best one. That's the easiest one. If you can get people scared, they're gonna do all sort of, whatever you want, and it turns out because of our biology, we're all kind of scaredy cats because, well, frankly, that's a good defense against saber-toothed tigers and things. It's good to be scared. So for evolutionary reasons, we get scared easily, frightened easily. And as a result, bad guys know this, whether they know it, intellectually or they just kind of gut intuit it. They often, so in your case, it wasn't fear, right? It was greed. And that's how, that would get me too, by the way. I don't get scared easily because I've learned, don't be scared by emails because that's usually a bad guy. But the greed's a good one. We have a package. It's got to have something wonderful in there. Wouldn't you like to get it? Well, we can't deliver it until you go to this site. Getcha. The fear one, of course, that's why the IRS, they use the IRS a lot. The IRS doesn't send email, but if it did, it should be scary. We're about to put a lien on your, we're going to garnish your wages unless you respond within 24 hours. That kind of thing. Yikes. Who wouldn't want to respond to that? Yikes. Valentine's Day on Tuesday. I didn't even mention that. FedEx has my email address because I have a FedEx account, a UPS account. So I do get legitimate emails. I get email all the time from FedEx, actually. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. What's that sound? Well, it's the sound of Richard being hijacked by ransomware. So, Richard, right. just to recap, Richard's calling from Oceanside. He's got a business. He opened an email from FedEx that said, we got a package for you, but we can't deliver it. Uh-oh. And they said to click a link, and they wanted you to download something?
Well, I don't even know I had to download it. I just clicked the link, and that was...
That was all it took. And then, boom, how long did it take before you got the message, we've encrypted all your files?
Oh, about 10 minutes.
Okay. So what? So in between the time you clicked the link and the time you got that message, what did you think happened?
Oh, I knew what happened.
Oh, you knew even before you saw it.
Oh, no. Well, when I hit the open that link, I saw the URL on the message that I was
opened,
and it didn't say FedEx.com on it.
No, very smart. So,
that's
an important point because emails can hide what the real address of the link is.
Yeah.
You know, it might say FedEx.com in the email, but if you hover your mouse over that link, on most email clients, it'll show the actual email.
Well, the link for the email link that was sent didn't.
Yeah, it came from like FedEx.Russia.Hacker.com.
That's right.
Yes. Yeah, that's another way to know, right? If you get email from a company and it's not the company's name.com,
Right. Exactly.
But you even saw all these. Nevertheless, we move quickly on computers, and we just boom, and we don't think sometimes. So what happened? So they said, send us Bitcoin.
That's right, Bitcoin, and if you don't, in 72 hours or something like that, it's going to be all your data. You'll never get your data back.
Yeah, the theory is they've used strong encryption to do this. They have a key that will unlock it, but they don't keep it for longer than 3 days. And that's just to make sure you don't, you know, that you respond. I should point out that even if you sent them the Bitcoin, it's not unusual for you to get either nothing or a key that doesn't work.
So let me tell you what happened here. This is very interesting. So I have a workstation at my office. It's all in one. So I unplugged it and took it home because I don't have computers on a network there.
Smart man. Good man.
So I can, you know, not infect anything else.
Yep.
And I looked at that screen and that's what it said and whatnot. So my son comes over and he's a computer programmer. He's been, you know, doing computers since he was a little kid. Now he's like 37. And so I'm showing him this, and he's looking at it, and he's kind of scratching his head, and he starts kind of looking around at some stuff. And I'm going, okay, suit yourself. You know, you'll never be able to do anything. Well, he actually reversed it.
How did he do that?
Okay. Well, I probably should have been watching him when he did this. But
he did some magic.
Well, what he did is he went on the Internet and found some place. And with instructions.
Oh yeah.
And the instructions were to download a file that was encrypted and download the same exact file that wasn't encrypted.
Right. So you actually reverse, and this is this only works, alas, with some ransomware. It's poorly written in such a way that you can reverse engineer the encryption key. But this is, and I've known about this for some time. We've talked about it on our security show and so forth. But that doesn't work with all ransomware. You just lucked out. You got some badly written ransomware.
This was interesting because they
made a crypto mistake that's kind of fundamental, basic crypto mistake.
What they did is we had an encrypted file, but we were looking for where's a file that isn't encrypted.
Right.
And so what they did is the instruction said to go into photographs and look in the ones that come as a sample when you buy your computer.
Because everybody's got that one, right?
Right.
Right.
And so we had the encrypted one, and then they downloaded the original one from the Internet.
This doesn't work if it's well-done encryption, but what you were able to do is compare a known file and its encryption with another file and figure out what the key is because they're reusing the keys over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And so that is a well-known category of ransomware. It's poorly coded, Don't count on that happening again.
Oh, okay.
Because that doesn't work every time. It only works with this one variant, this poorly written variant of ransomware.
Okay, what about this? So now I've got this computer and that's had ransomware on it. If I reformat that...
Oh, you're fine.
That would take care of it.
Yeah, you're fine. In fact, the chances are you could find that ransomware and remove it, because most of the time with ransomware, its payload is entirely encrypting your computer, encrypting your data, and it's not trying to open up holes and other stuff, because at that point it figures you're not going to ever use that computer again anyway. So
yeah.
So you're probably okay just removing that particular ransomware, but let's err on the side of prudence and delete everything and start over.
So how many times do you think you have to rewrite?
You don't. No, don't worry about that.
Just one time. Just format it.
You don't even have to rewrite it. Just format it and reinstall Windows.
All right. All right.
Oh, you lucked out. You have a smart friend, and you got a particularly weak form of ransomware.
Well, and don't forget the clean living.
And of course, you neither smoke, drink, nor hang out with fast women. So you're okay. Hey, I'm really glad you shared this experience, because I think sometimes we talk about this and it's so abstract that people don't take it seriously. So, it's nice.
It's abstract when it shows up on that screen.
Oh, man, your heart must have just dropped. Wow. You're very lucky to have, you had a good combination of factors. And I bet you'll be very careful about opening emails from FedEx ever again.
Well, I just have to look at the URL.
Yeah, just look carefully.
You can see them all the time on there. I mean, I'm deleting this stuff all the time.
Don't let fear or greed. See, so hackers will always do this. They will use strong emotions to get you to act without thinking. The number one is fear. Somebody's broken into your bank account and we want to verify it, or things like that. Or this is the IRS and in 24 hours we're going to start garnishing your wages unless you respond. Fear is very effective. Humans are geared to respond to fear and act viscerally without thinking. But the next best one is greed, and that's what they were going for with you. You got a package.
Well, I got an email one time from the IRS and they were threatening to take away my Viagra.
Well, now that I'd take seriously. Hey, it's great to talk to you, Richard. I appreciate it. Well, we had a lot of fun today. I'm glad you were here. We've learned something, haven't we, about ransomware. We do this show every week, and I do hope you'll stop by and join me all week long. I do more technology shows on the Internet through our TWIT network. TWIT stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv. They're all free. You can subscribe to them, or you can download them, and you can listen, you can watch, and you can learn. And I'll be back next week. Thanks to Mike Cozio, our musical director, to Kim Schaffer for answering the phones. Thanks to you, most of all, for being here. I really appreciate it, and I'll see you next time. I'm Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great Geek Week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, it's just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows on the Netcast Network. It's called TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. You even get your daily dose of tech news with Tech News Today. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guy show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.